Thank you. I appreciate your comments. I mean, look, part of what I think is, at least for me, so, you know, I largely agree with you. I mean, my issue every day is you wake up and you ask yourself, what am I going to do today? You know, am I going to write? Am I going to resist? Am I going to do something political, cultural? Am I going to try and reach out to my neighbors, my community? The Aboriginal community that we did work with in Australia continue to resist. Now, do they have any crazy ideas in their head of what the future may hold? No. But what gives me, I don't want to call it hope, what lights a fire under my ass is when I run into those kind of communities. Because I sit here and I think, well, I'm a working class white dude, no wife or husband, no kids, I worry about myself, I don't really have to worry about too much. But then I go into communities like that, and I say, well, here's a community that's 400 years of genocide, a community that's lost 200 languages, Aboriginal Australians, culture's been destroyed, imprisoned, beaten, tortured, decades of cultural genocide, and still, the people I'm running into are the most impoverished in Australian society, and they're sitting there with smiles on their faces, telling me, hey, Vince, we have to resist. We have to. It's not, are we going to resist just because we're going to win? It's, oh no, this is what we have to do. This is our duty. And that's kind of how I look at some of this, just to put that out there. Because I agree with you. And as I mentioned earlier, it's a conversation Kim and I have constantly. It's not to promise people, hey, if you get involved, everything's going to be okay. We can't say that to anyone. But what all we can tell people is, hey, if you don't get involved, it's guaranteed that things are going to get worse. And number two, in my opinion, it's the least we can do. And here I agree with somebody like Alice Walker, who basically, I mean, to paraphrase her quote, is that activism is your rent for living on the planet. I agree. I mean, if you have the ability to be an activist, if you have an ability to stand up to injustice, whether that be social injustice or environmental injustice, I think it's absolutely our duty to do that. So, even in light of all of that,
Well, it's your sanity. It is to keep our sanity that we are doing something.
Yeah, I agree.
But regardless of that,
when you're talking to people and you're asking them, what can we do? How can we fix this? A lot of times you get how people don't think that they can change it. It's a thing where it's almost like a hopelessness to where we're watching all this happen, and it's just like we're the viewers. It's like some TV show that we're watching.
The one thing I want to say in response to that is this is a reflection I get from a lot of folks. There's a lot of movements who are operating in silos. So if you look, like, I have friends who, and there's demographic breakdowns here too. So if you look at what's going on in Standing Rock, the majority of the environmental movement right now is indigenous and is white, middle class to upper middle class white people. That is where the movement's at. Yes, there are Hispanic and Latino activists there. Yes, there are black activists there. But the movements, in a lot of ways, are demographically segregated. I saw this in the anti-war movement where for 5 years, I went all over the country, almost every state in the country giving talks, and it was largely older white people. Black Lives Matter, we work with different groups, well, really around the whole region, but if you look at the Black Lives Matter organizations in Chicago, and even, let's say, the Black Lives Matter organization in Gary, Indiana, one that I'm somewhat familiar with, largely an all black organizations. Some young white college students are involved, but these movements and these folks, there's some overlap. There's people who are working with BLM who are also going to environmental movement, who also work with the labor movement, who also go to anti-war events and so on, but it's a lot of what you're mentioning. And my friends, it's interesting you say it, because my friends who aren't full-time activists, like if I just bring a neighbor or a cousin or somebody to an event, my brother, whoever, the first thing they notice is how separate everything is. They look around and they're like, I thought this was for the war in Iraq. Now, there's a simplistic angle to this where it's like you have to understand that U.S. foreign policy is, there's a connection between Palestine and Iraq, there's a connection with Iraq and Afghanistan and so on, but there's always this confusion, like, why aren't other movements here that should be supporting this? And number two, and this is my big beef with Jill Stein's campaign, is there's too many issues. I mean, we all know that there all these issues are on the table, but I agree here. Jeffrey St. Clair from Counterpunch just wrote an article. He's been all, you know, he's been supporting Jill Stein from the beginning. But a critical point that he makes, and he's right on, is that one of the things that Bernie's campaign did that got people interested was they were like, here's our five things. This is it. This is what we're going to harp on for 12 months, and this is what's going to get people excited. Stein's campaign is all over the place. I mean, it's this issue, this issue, this issue. It's not a cohesive and coherent narrative that people can pick up on and say, you know what? I'm about that. I can organize with that. That motivates me. So, yeah, that's what comes to mind when you're saying what you're saying. So thank you.
I don't think as cynical as you are. I actually believe that things may change very rapidly, and they're capable of changing very rapidly. A year ago, we didn't have the event of the Bernie Sanders campaign, and now we do. And he did, for me, three things that the left has been trying to do for years. Number one, he raised the question of socialism. No matter what he believes about it, it made it acceptable to talk about it. Second, he pointed the finger directly at the enemy, which is the top 1%, the corporations and the banks. And third, he pointed out the funding of the Democratic and Republican parties, both by the corporate entities. So he did three things and that happened very rapidly. We need to build independent political organizations, both electoral and on the ground, that encompass the kind of movements you're talking about.
You know, speaking of independent political organizations, it's a shame, but one of my great friends, Roberto Clack, I don't know if anyone here is familiar with him, I know Kim is, he lives in Pilsen, and they took some of that energy. It's one of the only cases I know of where there has been an IPO set up, an independent political organization set up, not attached to either party. I think their ideology is good, their program's good. But that was one of the few groups I know. So the 25th Ward IPO, I suggest the people who are here in Chicago check them out. That's 25th Ward IPO out of Pilsen. They've been one of the few groups I know of, at least personally, who have taken some of that energy. Because there's a lot, like after the election ended, it was very interesting. A lot of the folks I know who supported Bernie went in many different directions. And there are people who are like, I'm done forever with the Democratic Party. There's people who are working with the Democratic Party. There's people who are working with the Greens. There's people who have went home disenchanted. But then there's also a whole other group of people. And we actually just had an event in Northwest Indiana where over 75 people showed up who worked with the Bernie campaign. And they said, look, we're not interested in the Greens. We're not interested in the Democrats. We're not interested in our revolution, this, I kind of think, BS group that Bernie has set up. But we are interested in doing something and taking this momentum. And they're doing, really, on the ground what you're talking about. So that's a group that I really would like to point people to, is the 25th Ward IPO. There was supposed to be about a half dozen of them here today. Unfortunately, they got bogged down knocking on doors. There's a campaign they're running right now about rent and gentrification, housing rights in Pilsen. So, you know, God bless them. I'm glad they're doing that as well. But anyway, that's...
I would add the 12th Ward has an IPO as well, and if there's anybody from the South Side, we're trying to form one on the South Side. I'm down at 85th Street.
Good talk. One of the things that I find really discouraging is that much of the analysis focuses on economics. They ignore the political, and they're both there. And I think it's not an either or combination, but it's a primacy thing. And if you combine those two, I think we have to deal with the concept of the U.S. empire. Now, you spoke about that, but 99 9/10 of the left won't mention the word empire. I think that's what we are. And I think it actually gives us some opportunity because from my work, because I teach in Northwest Indiana, is that when I put it to my students, we can either spend $640 billion a year for the military, as we've been doing, or we can take care of the American people. What do we see over and over again? They almost unanimously say, let's take care of the American people. I think that's a tremendously important finding. Now, tied to that, I want to, and this here's where I want to get you to comment. Most of the folks in here, I would guess, are familiar or perhaps came through the Marxist movement. And you have said that the young people today that you know of have nothing or little empathy for that. And I'd like you to talk about that. What's the difference? Because I think that's something important that we older ones who came through the Marxist movement are aware of, and I think it needs to be put out on the table.
Yeah, that's, I mean, look, this is probably a whole nother presentation. But I think Kim brings up a really important point. You know, when people ask me, and I harped on this a little bit earlier, when people say, like, well, how did you become politically active, politically engaged, and so on? I mean, again, it wasn't through going to a conference about Marx. It wasn't like reading the manifesto or looking at excerpts in my Western philosophy course in college or so on. I mean, it was, there was a lot of, I would say, cultural mechanisms that pushed me in this direction. And as I mentioned, some of them were very simple. It was reading literature, reading people like Kurt Vonnegut and William S. Burroughs and Hunter S. Thompson, and reading about the 60s counterculture, listening to music, reading about the 50s beat culture. I mean, this was sort of what I was stuck with in the barracks in the Marine Corps. I didn't, there wasn't much of a counterculture going on at the time under Bush administration back in 2004-2005. But this also leads to me getting engaged with the movements when I come home. And I've talked to, you know, someone who else who talks a lot about this is Christian Parenti. And I forget how he put it, but he's like, it's almost like an inoculation to Marxism. Like, when I got, it wasn't that I was opposed to Marx. I didn't grow up with any of that shit. Like, most of us who are 32, 35, younger, 20s, like, there was no Cold War, there was no McCarthyism. Like, none of us are like, oh, Marx, that's a bad idea. No. Actually, to be honest with you, what made me cynical of Marx, about Marx and all of this, was joining the movement and running into Marxists. It was like, oh, shit. I'm like, you know, I'm working with the ISO and all these, I mean, it's like the Monty Python thing. It's like, well, what Marx are you? Like, well, no, I'm the People's Revolutionary Party. What party are you? Well, I'm the Revolutionary Party. And I'm like, what are you guys? Well, I'm Maoist. I'm Trotz. I'm Leninist. I'm like, holy shit. I'm like, I don't know where any, you know, I mean, there's a historical history, serious conversations that should happen with that, but it's not, to be honest with you, it's the opposite. It wasn't what got me involved or what kept me involved. It was almost like an inoculation to Marx, where after running into those folks, I was like, you know what, I've got little time for the Marxists now, because I'm like, Jesus Christ, like the groups I've worked with in the past, they almost are like, have guaranteed that my friends and I aren't going to come to their events, because just the way they operate, the way they organize, the way they approach people, the way that they're trying to educate people, and I'm painting a very broad brush, but I would probably argue people in this room have had similar experiences. I see a lot of smirks, so I don't think there's too many people here who would disagree with that. So I think that's really important, because there's a whole new generation of activists who are coming up who, for me, there's kind of a contradiction here. Number one, no, we didn't become radicalized because of Marx or because of these traditional leftist institutions. One of the biggest, of course, being organized labor. Like, none of my friends are in unions. I mean, I'm in the National Writers Union, but it's not a real union. I mean, the other people I know, they're working $7.25 an hour jobs because that's the minimum wage in Indiana. They're serving tables. They work at big box stores. That's it. They're in the service industry. They're in the service sector. Like, they have no, there's no, like, industrial tradition. There's no organized labor tradition. It doesn't exist. So it's really interesting to talk to, and I think I told Robert, you know, part of what I would like to do to help folks here, because I feel really strongly about what you're doing here, providing a free space for people to explore these ideas. I think part of what I would like to help do is to bring in some of these younger activists, you know, like, have a presentation from the folks at Standing Rock. Have a couple young indigenous activists here to talk about what they're doing, what they're thinking, what they're reading. Have some of the young Black Lives Matter or Asada's Daughters, or Youth Project 100 folks come, show up, tell you, hey, this is what we're reading, this is what we're doing, this is what's turning our people on. I think something like that could be really beneficial. And I think, because I also don't like this generational divide. Like, I hate when people are like, oh, well, it's the young people, or it's the old folks, or whatever. Some of my best friends, including Kim, Paul Street, who's younger than Kim, and others, some of my best friends are 50, 60, 70 years old. And some of my other friends are 18 and 19 and 20 years old. But I think there's a lot we can learn from one another. So it's not to just come here, I don't want to say, oh, you all you old Marxists are just antiquated ideas and blah, blah, blah. And also, but for the old people to recognize, or older folks to recognize, hey, it's not just all these young kids are just young and ignorant, they don't get it yet, you know, they should be Marxists, but they're not. There has to be some give and take. And I think exploring those ideas and having those conversations with one another is really where it's at. But to recognize that, yeah, we're not coming from the same traditions as the 68 generation, that's for damn sure.
What I want to go on to say is Black Lives Matter, they wrote out a set of principles and what they wanted to see America be like and do, and they wrote out what they want and how to get there.
Yeah, and the only thing I'll say about that, about the platform, the only issue I've seen with that so far is applying that to the different local groups. So part of what we've seen with the local BLM groups is sort of a lack of cohesion with other groups who call themselves BLM, because there's no like official organizational structure. And now I'm not saying this because I want some centralized body or whatever. I'm just simply saying, like, that's the only thing that came to mind when you mentioned that, because I saw the platform as well. And the issue that we've had is that the local groups in some ways don't see themselves as being sharing some of those ideas, wanting it to be different. I'm sure all that's natural as well. I think it's positive.
I start with the fact that I am 76 years old, and I am intimidated by a lot of the world. It's big. There's so many problems out there. My mother had a saying from Shakespeare, "Unto thine own self be true." And I think we can't be true unto our own selves unless we sincerely treat our body as our temple and start working toward things that make our environment and our lives better.
In terms of industrial agriculture, check out Richard Manning's work. So it's not just, that's a good example, but the actual process of monolithic crops is hugely destructive. The entire process and the idea of industrial agriculture, at least ecologically speaking, is a travesty. So it is chemical war on the earth, and it's turned, speaking of chemical war on the earth, as one scientist recently mentioned, is basically turned the soil into a junkie. So without the kind of petrochemicals and petrol fertilizers that we use, the soil is virtually dead because of this, decades and decades of it. So Richard Manning's work on industrial agriculture, it's as good as it gets.
A couple of things that have really moved me over the years, and one is in Barbara Tuchman's Last Salute, which is a historical work about the American Revolution. She wrote about a Dutch.
What's the name?
The Last Salute, and her last name is Tuchman. She wrote The Guns of August. She wrote about a Dutch trader who, in the struggle for about to push off the Spanish colonialism, and he was in the last part of that, but he was assassinated because he was effective in organizing. And his saying was, you do not need hope to persevere. That's one. Second of all, when we went down to Argentina, where my husband is from, we marched with the Mothers of the Plaza de Mayo, and I bought a book that they had written in English, and Argentina has more psychologists and psychiatrists per capita than anybody else in the world. One of the things that they found out with research was that the families that resisted the military dictatorships that were down there, the families that resisted were the ones that were psychologically more healthy because of that resistance.
Yeah, I have many friends who concur. And two things you bring up that I think we should talk about, and that I think will be useful for people to ponder after this, is number one, biological limits. There are biological limits. I hear this too from my leftist friends. They want to sort of break everything back down into the social environment or the social sciences, but I would recommend that everyone here spend as much time with the natural sciences as they do with the social sciences, because there are biological limits to what we can do. And what you mentioned about the cornfields and industrial agriculture is a perfect example. Their ecology and the biology is so complex that a lot of us, or a lot of people, professionals, experts, and so on, are just now starting to learn those complexities. What's interesting to me, though, is how indigenous cultures understood those complexities without microscopes and so on, which tells me there's a lot more that needs to be done with regard to the heart and morals, ethics, philosophy, reflecting on who we are in this planet, in this existence, and so on. And that's, I think, something that a lot of people kind of brush off, you know? I mean, we talk about this with a lot of activists. Sometimes they just want to talk about political program. They don't want to sit back and maybe question what that means and what the implications would be if you do come to the conclusion that there are biological limits here. And another thing I did not mention at all is patriarchy. You know, this is also something that is a major, major, major component to what's going on. It's not only a major component to why I joined the military. It's not only a major component of why I think the military is an inherently destructive institution, what it produces, what happens within those institutions, but it's virtually every institution that we have in our society that has these patriarchal structures. And then, of course, the way that those things play out in the real world. So those are two things that I did not mention. So thank you for mentioning them.
You have a radio program.
Yes.
Is that on AM 820?
No, they wouldn't let me on there, I don't think. 820, oh God, with Wayne Bessett and that asshole's over there. No. Unfortunately, I wish I was. Look, a bigger platform, the better. I'm on the Progressive Radio Network, which you can access online. At just Google the Progressive Radio Network, and then Google my name, and okay, it'll all come up. You don't even have to do specific search. Just Google it, it'll be there, okay, and you can find it.
A very brief comment. I was born and raised in the states of Montana and Washington, and had education both in the parochial schools and later in the public schools. And then in Washington, I lived next to the Yakima Indian Reservation, where I heard a different version of American history than what I was taught. And I have come to realize through a number of events, including living in New York, one of the primary, perhaps the most fundamental thing, you mentioned this patriarchy, is a basic religion of American history and what America means, that as far as I'm concerned, should be destroyed as much as possible in every way that we can in terms of.
And I think that gets to Kim's point. So to close out, in order to understand the United States as an empire and in order to understand us as an economic hegemon and so on and so forth, the only way to do that is to properly understand American history. And I think the more we talk about American history, because another thing I'm hearing, and I know Robert's like probably ready to freak out, but another thing that I'm hearing from a lot of people too in my generation is, oh, since World War II, I keep hearing that everything since World War II has gone bad. But you know, before that it was kind of, no, we really need to get to that point, because in order to understand what Kim's saying, that we are an empire, and then understand that history, there's no way to understand it without understanding the history of the Revolutionary War, Native American genocide, and slavery. So with that being said, thanks a lot, Robert, and thanks for having me, folks.